The door doesn't stay closed for long. The owner of inside the patio hangs a piñata. The piñatas are the highlight of the posada, for the children at least. Depending on their means, the host and hostess may have from 1 to 8 or 10 piñatas. They are hollow jars made of thin clay and decorated in all sorts of odd shapes and colors. They have been filled with such things as hard candy, nuts, tiny oranges, dried fruits, and sometimes small toys. But first, the pilgrims must have some refreshments. Here the hostess has made up small bags of candy. Now comes the most exciting moment of all. Who will have first chance to break the piñata? Let's see. Diego is the lucky boy, and a blindfold is put over his eyes. Next, Diego is handed a long stick and turned around 3 times. Now he's supposed to hit the piñata with his stick and break it. But this isn't as easy as it looks. After striking out a few times, Diego finds the range and brings down his pita. The breaking of the piñata is a signal for all the youngsters to dive in and get their share of the good things that come tumbling out. Tomorrow, we're going to leave the warmth of Mexico, visit a land where they have a really white Christmas. We're going to spend a holiday in a small Swedish village.
About 10 years ago, when the United States Chamber of Commerce, later supported by the National Planning Association, called for the elimination of from one-half to two-thirds the American farmers, few people accepted this as a serious threat. Every day, more evidence is unfolding in the countryside to confirm the determination of the present administration in Washington to carry through that program. More and more, as the program unfolds, economic ruination, bankruptcy, collapsing living standards spread among the farming people. It becomes evident, too, that the ricocheting political bullets intended to eliminate the millions of small farmers threaten small-town business, including the cooperatives, the American labor movement, and the traditional democratic rights of the American working people. On October the 28th, 1955, at a meeting staged at the Fargo-Moorhead Chamber of Commerce and held in the carefully selected Red River Valley area of Moorhead, Minnesota, Agricultural Secretary Ezra Taft Benson offered a defense of his farm policy. It was in this setting that Benson defended the elimination of what he described as inefficient farmers from the land, significantly concluding, "Those who now bemoan the new movement of people from farm to non-farm jobs are peddling a cheap brand of demagoguery." It is worthy of note that among the reports to the recent Senate committee hearings on agriculture was one from a cooperative and chamber of commerce from Minnesota Rangetown, the iron mine region of the state, noting that 40% of this community's farmers had quit farming in just 1 year. The decline in farm income, particularly the recent sharp decline in hog and cattle prices, has been devastating in its effect. Only recently, the Agriculture Department reported the farm parity ratio at 81%, its lowest level in 15 years. 100% of parity determined by measuring farm income against operating and living expenses would presume a price for farm commodities fair to the farmer and consumer alike. The area in which the aforementioned Benson speech was given is heavy beet growing territory, where the gross returns from beets per acre run from $70 to $120 an acre, with net returns of from $40 to $80. The government paid subsidy amounts to about $4 a ton for, or about $45 an acre. Yet it was in such a setting that Benson could comfortably and hypocritically declare that compensatory payments, broadly applied, would result in a frankly socialized agriculture. Little wonder that President Eisenhower's popularity in the farm area dropped sharply on October 29th when he pledged 100% support to Benson's policies. Nor did Harold Stassen, prominent Republican and presidential assistant on disarmament, increase his popularity by defending Benson in St. Paul on November the 28th. The best evidence of the powerful sentiment and unity among the farming people against the administration's farm policies is the large number of Republican congressmen and senators from the upper Midwest who oppose the administration's policies and the Democratic Party's leaders' recent conversion to support 90% price supports. More evidence is the mushrooming growth of the National Farm Organization, built with its demand for emergency government action to support hog prices at $20 per hundredweight and cattle prices at $30 per hundredweight. There are other evidences. Aside from the threat to labor of plunging hundreds of thousands of farmers eliminated from farming into the already crowded labor market, organized labor is also threatened by increasing demands expressed in Republican County newspapers in Minnesota, calling for a political climate attractive to job-creating industries, and declaring, as the Granite Falls Tribune does, that Minnesota is becoming known as a labor racketeering state, and charges that you first have to do business with organized labor or you don't do business in Minnesota. The anti-labor howls of the Republican newspapers of Minnesota constitute virtual calls for war against the labor movement. And this pressure is rising primarily now as a result of the effort on the part of reaction to find jobs for the jobless, which includes hundreds of liquidated farmers, by enticing industries to come to local farming communities for cheap, unorganized labor. Upper Midwest farming communities are to run competition with unorganized southern labor and communities to solve the problem of jobs for liquidated farmers. These Republican newspapers make it clear they want nothing short of the destruction of the labor movement. At this moment, when the handful of bankrupt politicians are so determinedly pursuing their attack upon the farmers and demanding the destruction of the labor movement, labor now has the opportunity to weld a labor-farmer alliance in these states which already have strong labor-farmer traditions. The impact of the farm crisis in the upper Midwest is reflected in a number of ways. Every year, increasing numbers of farmers are compelled to enter the labor market. The rate at which farmers are being liquidated and driven into the towns is rising rapidly. Liquidation of 5% of the farmers of a county last year was not unusual. In some counties, it was still higher. Living standards of the farmers, payment of the indebtedness is declining, threatening the solvency of cooperatives, small business, and the banks. Militancy, comparable to the days preceding the emergence of the Farm Holiday Association in the 1930s, is rising in the upper Midwest countryside. The direction of that militancy today is toward independent political action on the part of labor and the farm movement. The farmer-labor political traditions of North Dakota's Nonpartisan League, the Minnesota Farmer-Labor Party, impels the labor and farm movement toward an independent political movement. This could well mean that the people of the upper Midwest, with their history of third-party movements, may lead the way in the development of a real mass third-party movement. Third-party movement.
We of the Minnesota Dakota Freedom of the Press Committee wish to extend our warmest good wishes to our many West Coast friends and to their paper, The People's World. With the attacks and harassment and intimidation of daily worker readers by the FBI snoopers, the circulation steadily declined over a 7-year period. In 1955, however, this decline was brought to a halt with an upward trend in circulation here. With a minimum of readers involved in the circulation thus far in this drive, we did secure 2.5 times the number of subs to the worker over what we did in December of 1954. And are confident that we can continue that pace to overfulfill our drive goals. The experience of one sub-getter who visited 12 new people and got 10 subs indicates great possibilities for securing many new readers in 1956, greatly helping to advance the cause of peace, jobs, and the struggles of the Negro people.
And then I started reading. Wait a minute. Let me get myself lined up here. There's a 1908 when I fired on the homestead. It's 5 miles inside to the boundary line from North Dakota into South Dakota. I can remember when we went out to build my shack out there on the homestead. My brother went along, it was 17 miles from town. We got there about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And by dark, we had shack all built. We had the bunk made. We had the table made and the bench to sit on. Actually, we had the tarp paper on the roof. And the door was hung on the hinges. I walked around that shack. I looked at the walls, the roof, and also at the land upon which it stood. At last I had land in a small house. Yes, small, but nevertheless it was the nucleus, what I thought was going to be my home for a long time. How many millions of people have gone through the same exuberant feeling before me? Perhaps it was only a cave or a mud hut, or perhaps a log cabin. Whatever it was, it did represent what we'd hoped was security and a shelter against the elements. After we had the table and the bench all done, we sat down outside the shack looking at the land, talked about the future that we thought was in store for us in this new land. The fact that this was the first time within millions of years that a house had been built on this land never occurred to us. After it got too dark to see the land anymore, we went in and lit the brand new kerosene lamp, built a fire in the brand new stove, and proceeded to cook our supper. I also had beautiful visions. Yeah. As I lay in that bunk for the first time, I had visions of a farm stocked with cattle, horses, and waving fields of grain. And my visions were not marred by any doubts about the fulfillment either. But life goes on, and visions changes to reality. As I stated before, I was on my second lap in my search for knowledge. Next morning we got up as the sun peeped over the horizon, and we cooked our breakfast of pancakes and bacon. After breakfast, we took a walk over the land, and we had both agreed that the land was very, very good. And my vision of the future became much brighter. When we got back to the shack, my brother decided to go back home. He had 13 miles or 17 miles to walk. And I said, you better wait for a ride. But he says, oh, I'll make it easy before noon. And then he had 2 miles beyond the reader yet, it was 19 miles. But, as I said, visions change to reality. And there come the time when I had to make this farm productive, make it a real farm. So I proved up on this homestead. I went to the banker and I borrowed $600. Now I had a mortgage, 12% interest. And we also organized a township. And we had an election, and I was elected town clerk, but there was nobody had the authority to swear anybody in, so I had to find a justice of the peace somewhere. And I had been plowing, doing my fall plowing. I had a walking plow, 4 old horses and old harness. And when I got home at night, they were tired. So after supper, I decided I'd walk the 9 miles to see the JP, because I had to get those papers sworn to. I got there about 11 o'clock at night. Everything was dark. I pounded on the door. And finally, I succeeded to wake him up. And he wanted to know who was out there. I told him it's me. He said, what do you want? I said, I want you to swear me in. He said, swear you in? To what? I said, to office. And so he came out in his long underwear, cursing, of course, opened the door and said, what the hell do you want? What are you talking about? I says, I want you to swear me into office. Wait a minute, he says, wait a minute. So he goes back and fumbled around in the dark and found a match and he lit the kerosene lamp that was stood on the kitchen table. He says, you better come on in and tell me what you want. So I says, well, I want you to swear me in. I says, we organize a township out there. And I finally convinced him that he had an official duty to perform. And so he looked at my papers very thoroughly, and he says, well, they look legal-like and good. He says, I think it's okay. So he says, now he says, I don't suppose you have to swear very hard. He says, I'll just sign my name to this. I says, yes, but it should be written in ink. So he says, Mata, have we got any ink in there? Very sleepily, she answered, yes, maybe we have some here. So she come out with the ink. He signed my papers, and his wife, Sarah, she witnessed them. Here I was now a sworn in officer of a local government. I started for home. I had to wade the river to get back. I waded across. I took off my pants and my shoes and my stockings. The water reached up about to my waist. But after I got across, I put my shoes back on, my clothes. I started for home, 9 miles. Here I was, a respectable citizen. I had 160 acres of land and a mortgage. I was now also a member of a new government. As I was walking along, I was thinking about this. There's never been a government there before. All during the world's history, the first government on that spot. That is the kind of government that we have, white civilized people. I know the west, on the west part of my homestead, there was rings of stone that shows that there had been an Indian settlement at one time, Indian camp. And the creek that went through my land had clam shells. Shows that there had been running water at one time, maybe 100, 200 years ago. I wouldn't know how long ago, but it was some time ago, because the stones were sunk way down to the ground. You could hardly see them. But these Indians, they must have had some kind of a government, no doubt about that. But as I said, they had no mortgages or boundary lines, and therefore they couldn't have the same kind of a government as we did. They came out in the spring, and they shot the buffalo they needed for meat for the winter, and they all went back to the winter home, the hills, Black Hills, when winter came. They all went. Some of the white people goes to the winter homes too. It depends on which end of the mortgage you're on. So the Indians didn't have any mortgage, they could all go. See, we have many kinds of mortgages. There's the real estate mortgage. To get that mortgage, you have to have first get title to some property that's fastened to the Mother Earth itself, or part of the earth. And for instance, you have a house with a little ground around it, and the boundary line, it's got to be boundary lines, the mortgage would be no good. But anyhow, that's called a real estate. So you can borrow money, you get a mortgage on it. That's the real estate mortgage. And then we had the chattel mortgage, you know. You have to get a chattel mortgage, you got to get something you can move around, like a cow or a horse, or nowadays we got the automobiles and so on, the refrigerators and all that stuff. But that's what they call a chattel mortgage. And of course, then there's a second and a third mortgage, a third and fourth mortgage. Each of the get, if you don't pay the interest on the other mortgage, you can get the rest of it. And then, of course, the rumors that report went around that at one time they also had mortgage on the wives, but unlike the horses and the cattle, they could talk back so they never become popular. Of course, that didn't work out so good. But I mean, the Indians didn't have that kind of a thing. One advantage they had over us because they could go away and then come back in the spring and the buffalo would be all there and nobody foreclosed on them. Same with the land. They could put the camps, the tents up again because nobody foreclosed on the land when it was gone. So they had one advantage over us, even if they were uncivilized, you know. But time went on, as I said, visions changed to reality. First crop I had was a complete failure. I couldn't pay the interest on the mortgage. Second crop was good, but the prices were so low that it didn't even pay the expenses of harvesting, sowing it and all that. So here I was 2 years I didn't pay interest. So I already had the third mortgage. And I got plenty of them before I get through. What I'm trying to point out is we came there full of hope. I went out on an excursion train that was full of people, land-hungry people. Seeing this prairie stretch before their eyes. And they had hopes of building homes for the future. I came back there many years afterwards. I went to Dakota, these mortgages spread all over. I went up to Canada and found them there too. The mortgages had different, they're written a little different in Canada. There's something about the imperialistic crown attached to the paper, but the mortgages worked the same way. And I remember during the Depression days, we got 60 bushels of wheat to the acre. We had so much wheat, it was worthless. The banker wouldn't even take the wheat to pay it to get as paper on a mortgage. And yet it said we had to pay the mortgage. I mean, the mortgage worked the same on other. And as I came back many years after, I went back over the land that I homesteaded. I could see the barbed wire hanging on posts that were broken down and rot. I could see the holes where the little shack stood. Maybe the mother gone down in that cellar that now is just a little hole with a little fruit after some garden stuff perhaps. In the fall maybe she filled that cellar full of garden stuff and food. It's all gone now. Changed completely. The mortgages have done a wonderful job and eliminated a lot of people. I could go on and on about this question of mortgages. You could write history about the Middle West. It's very interesting if you want to read it. I don't know if that's... I remember the first furrow that we plowed on my land. I'll never forget that. We measured out 10 acres. I hired my neighbors to break it for me. He had 4 horses, which I didn't have at that time. And he sent his son over with those 4 horses and a breaking plow. And as I was still watching that turf, that sod, that probably lay there for millions of years, turn over. I never thought about the length of time that sod laid there. But that sod, as I watched that ribbon form clean across the land, 160 rods. And then he turned around to come back to another fur up against it. And I sat there, just sat there and watched as that boy turned up furrows over that soil and lay there so long. I had those 4 horses, the old harness and the walking plow. But I was very, very ambitious. Just to farm with those 4 horses and a walking plow was not enough. I seen the new tractors come into the land. One brand new tractor with 6 plows behind it. I felt that I had to have one of those. The agent for the company heard about that, and he also knew I had 160 acres of land. Those days wasn't hard to buy a tractor, a thrashing machine, or a stud horse. But I bought one of those tractors. I ran it all the land I could get hold of. I plowed night and day. I sharpened plow lathes in daytime, and I run the tractor at night. I remember one time, I'd just gone to bed after being up all night, and in fact I've been up over 60 hours without much sleep. And 11:30 I just sharpened the plow lathe and dropped asleep when the lad who was running it in daytime come and told me, he says, the tractor won't run. So I managed to get up, goes out to the tractor, and I knew that was what was wrong. The spider in the clutch with some 3 big screws in it. And it come loose. I tightened them. And then I fell asleep standing there with my hand in the flywheel on the clutch. The lad, seeing me standing still, thought I had it all fixed, and he goes on the other side and starts the tractor, and he got the ratchet moving. And as luck would have it, I woke up before the motor got over center. Otherwise, my hand would have got caught. It was almost 70 hours without sleep. Satisfied my ambition. That was the year we got that crop. A good crop. But the prices were so low that time I got through paying off the expenses of harvesting and sowing that crop, there was not enough left to pay the some mortgages. My mortgages were getting bigger and bigger. Okay. But I still had hopes. I kept on farming with the tractor. Next year I went at it again. I didn't put in quite so much then. That year, 1912, when I bought the tractor, I had over 800 acres. In 1913, I only had about 600 acres. But the crop looked good in the spring. Rain, and it came up nice, and I hadn't been home to see my folks for a long time, for many years. Like the not since 1909. And meanwhile, my father had sold the farm in Wisconsin, moved to Minneapolis. So I came to Minneapolis then. But in order to get there, I had to borrow some money to get there. So I go to the banker, and I said, I want to borrow $50. I want to go down and see my dad. I haven't seen him for a long time. And the crop looked good. And the banker says, yes, they get old very quick. He says, well, I'll loan you the money. Not because he was sympathetic, but the more money he loaned me, the more interest he'd get. And so I went to Minneapolis, seen my folks, come back home again. And when I came back, I found that the hot winds had come, and my wheat was all shriveled. It looked almost hopeless. The day after I come back, we got a heavy shower of rain. Some of the wheat revived. I got 6 bushels to the acre. Some 8. But it averaged up about 6 bushels to the acre. Prices were poor again. And the crop was small. So I couldn't pay the interest again. The mortgages had become bigger and bigger. Not because I didn't work hard enough. I certainly did work hard. And everybody said that I was going places because I worked so hard. But in 1915, the grasshoppers came in. I went back to my homestead, and I've been farming north of Reeder for a couple of years when we bought that tractor. But I went back to my homestead with a tractor, put in a crop there in 1915, and the grasshoppers came along, and they took everything. In 1916, I had the nicest crop I ever had. Wheat stood up almost to my shoulders. The black grass came. I never harvested one kernel. So that is the end of my farming. I let it go. I want to say hello to all those wonderful people up in San Francisco. That's you, Irene, Dr. Rob, Harris, Flo, Francis, all you people that I met out there. I often talk about you. And I hope someday I'll be able to come out and see you. Meanwhile, we got lots of work to do. All of it. That's all. Okay. It was during the month of February 1955 when I received word that my brother had passed over the Big Divide. It was 48 years ago when I attended my brother's wedding in Minot. It was in the spring of 1902 when he first saw the prairies of North Dakota. He also left the fertile soil of Wisconsin to find a place where he could build a home. He found the land he wanted, 18 miles from Carpio, North Dakota. And like myself and so many others, he built his first little homestead shack with a tar paper on the outside. And I'm still sure that he had the same hopes and the same ambitions that we all had when we first came out there. On the east side of his homestead was a deep coulee, and on the other side of this coulee lived his nearest neighbor, who had a beautiful daughter. And this beautiful girl became my brother's mate and the mother of his children. I bought a ticket on the bus for mine up North Dakota to go to this funeral. After 48 years, I again traveled over almost the same route which I took when I first rode on the excursion train to seek land. It was not the same. Instead of looking forward to a new life, I was now on my way to bury the dead. It was snowing in Minneapolis when I left. We could see the people shoveling the snow off the porches and automobiles. Gone were the horses and the lumber wagons. The roads were not the same dirt roads that mire the wagons in the spring. But there were other changes too, great changes. At the end of one cornfield stood a corn picker and the tractor with the trailer still hitched on, no horses. Even the bus which I travel on was something new and belonged to the new age. I told you about the stagecoach which took me to my brother's place near Reeder, North Dakota. I was now riding on a Sino cruiser. The mules which pulled that stagecoach would have been left very far behind as we traveled at 60 and 70 miles per hour. My brother had passed on with the old. As I traveled over the prairies of North Dakota, it made me feel as if I had seen a raped virgin left to die. When I first seen the land, the virgin prairie was still waiting for the plow. As we travel on, we see many empty homes. They are upset at the passing of the old to make room for the new. The kitchen steps were no longer there because the home was gone. Children no longer came running down these steps on their way to school or to play. The flower beds had grown to weeds. The mother who tended the tender plants had either passed over the Big Bighorn or had moved to some other place. As we passed one of those deserted farm places, we seen a cottontail sitting in the bushes where the garden used to be. His enemy, man, and his dog were gone. Instead of small farms of a quarter and half a section, we now saw farms of 1,000 acres or more. Bigger farms and fewer people. What happened to those people who used to live in these vacated farm places? We find them in the small towns and villages. Some were living on the money they managed to have left over after they sold their homes. But so many are existing in what we now call the old age assistance. We also find many of them in the cities, in a little one-room apartment with a gas plate and a little cupboard where they kept a few groceries they were able to buy without any future to look forward to. Yes, larger farms and fewer people, but this does not mean that we have fewer people in America, but fewer people have the opportunity to earn a decent living. As we came close to Bismarck, we saw the beautiful western prairie sunset. It seemed to me that when I see these sunsets, it does not mean the end of anything except in the day which had just passed, and that there will be a tomorrow which will bring forth a happier life for the people. As we traveled towards the west, the sunset became more beautiful. The fleecy clouds which were turning gold and silver, and the sky is soft and blue. A cloud came up to meet the sun. It did not appear to be an ominous cloud, but rather like a curtain in a window of a maiden's room, which intrigues you and makes you wonder what tomorrow has in store for you. We passed the Garrison Dam, and this made me wonder how many small farmers would benefit from the new power and irrigation projects. We passed the strip mines north of the Garrison Dam. It made me feel that the land had been looted and destroyed, never to be used again. But we know that someday the great mounds of soil will be smoothed out, and we will again see life where there is nothing but heaps of flack and clay. But the loop will be gone. We also know that there will come a time when the great reservoir of Garrison Dam would help to make a park of the prairies of North Dakota, where people will not have to live on old age assistance when they get old. As we rode along, we seen smoke from chimneys of lonely farmhouses, and there, here and there, we seen a clothesline with perhaps a few diapers for hanging, or perhaps a pair of small overalls. But when in the walls of those lonely farm places, for people living, each with a story to tell about life and death. We passed farm homes with large barns, beautiful houses. In the barnyard were large files and sleek cattle in the feedlots. I wonder what stories could be found in those homes. We passed government storage bins all along the highway, full of surplus grain. Or was it surplus grain? We have not time to answer the question, but it would be interesting to know. All along the route, we've seen many signs. Jesus saves. Eat in such and such a place. Buy this and buy that to save money. We passed graveyards of automobile worm. They were covered with snow. They looked more beautiful that way. But one could not help but wonder how many mortgages and debts could be traced back in the history of those old derelicts. An old timer got on the bus and sat down beside me. We commenced to talk about the weather, and then he asked me where I was going. I told him I was going to my brother's funeral. And he asked me where. I told him, Carpio, northwest of mine, about 40 miles. He sat still for a few minutes without saying anything. Then he said, I remember that country well. I used to thrash up in that country many years. Yes, those were the days. Many a night I crawled into the hay mow, haystacks, or some straw pile after the day's work was done. It was all large thrashing rigs those days. I can remember the old cook cars and the rickety wooden steps we used to climb during the dark mornings and evenings. Those days a man had to be a man. Nowadays everybody was riding automobiles. They're not sure where they're going and often they don't know what they're going to do when they get there. After a while I asked him what he thought of the Formosa situation. And he angrily replied, what the hell are we doing there anyhow? Then he fished a comic book out of his hip pocket, moved across the aisle, and did not want to talk anymore. Perhaps he did not want to talk out too loud. Or perhaps he did not feel sure that he was talking to the right person. I can also remember those good old days when we had to break the ice in the water barrel in the mornings before we could wash our hands and face. I remember we did not like it. In fact, we did a lot of cursing because we had to live in order, we had to do it in order to live. And I'm very sure that very few want to go back to those good old days. Then a newly married couple got on the bus. I thought they were on the honeymoon, but I soon found out that they were just coming back from the honeymoon to start their lives together. I sat there wondering what their plans were. They reminded me of my brother and his bride 48 years ago. As we passed little towns, we saw the remains of the days, when the sidewalks were new and the people were still full of hopes. The little stores with the rolls of calico and groceries on the shelves, and the round pot-bellied stoves in the center of the store, which was well saturated with choice tobacco juice. I was also thinking of Marithel's book, Salute to Spring, where she writes, we saw the dreary villages, the frail wooden houses, the prairie ravished, everything impermanent, as if it was not meant to last the span of a man's life, a husk through which human life poured, leaving nothing behind, not even memory, every man going a lonely way in a kind of void, all shouting to each other and unheard, all frightfully alone and solitary. When I finally arrived in Carpio, where my brother had bought the little house, where he had hoped to live a few remaining years in peace and contentment with his wife, I felt it was not only my brother's funeral that I had come to attend. I was also witnessing the passing of an era. The sidewalks, in part, were the same as where the town was new 50 years ago. The fault fronts looked more false than ever. No paint and loose boards to be seen, as if the buildings themselves were desperately clinging to life and hating to let go. As the bus drove down the little main street, the first store building was seen, was boarded up, but stood empty amongst those tall weeds surrounding it. It stood as a relic of the past. And I seem to throw out a challenge to the living. I dare you to ask yourself why I am allowed to remain. I have died, yet I remain amongst you. The saloon was a recreation center, and the building looked as if it was ready to collapse. There the farmers gathered to discuss their problems. They were also asking, where are we going? Yes, where are we going? My brother and myself had witnessed the passing of time, the transition from the horsepower to atomic power. Yes, where are we going? My brother had found it hard to know what to do with the new time. Somehow, some way, he and his mate had to find a way to conquer time. On the way, on the day he died, they had visited their only son in the afternoon and sat at the table and drank the traditional cup of afternoon coffee. He felt good and had succeeded to make that little part of his life pleasant and worth living. But it was time to drive home before it got dark. He no longer trusted himself to drive after dark. So he and his mate went back to the little home, the little cottage, amongst the tall elms. They cooked and ate their supper, washed the dishes. The evening lay before them, more time to be conquered. The evening had to be conquered so that they would not suffer from loneliness. They tried to listen to the TV, but the program was not interesting. If they only had programs which depicted the life they knew and understood. My brother suggested that his mate that they go over to the neighbors for a game of whist to pass the evening. The neighbors were also two old people who had bought a little home and had retired from active work. The time has also become their problem. They had spent a pleasant evening. It was time to go home and retire for the day. They walked slowly on the way home. My brother's mate was going to go ahead to turn on the lights. And as she was about to enter the lane between the tall elms lining the driveway, she looked back to see if her mate was coming. When she seen him throw up his arms and crumble to the snow in the middle of the street in front of their home. His time had run out. He was now 73 years old, but time no longer was his enemy. When I think about him, I also think about thousands upon thousands of old people who have lived, who have built this land, and they had to find some way to conquer time without any future except to try to exist to the end. The day after I arrived, we went to the funeral parlor to view his body. Not the happy gathering. As I looked at him in his casket, I noticed that for the first time in many, many years, his worried frown on his forehead was gone. At last, he was free from the worries about mortgages and the struggle to survive. His face looked so peaceful. Why should we grieve? He had passed the age where he couldn't plow and sow, and that had been his life. He had not prepared himself for anything else. And when he ceased to plow and sow, his life work ended. Their only son rented the farm, and while they still owned it, they at least felt that the soil on the land was part of themselves. But then they sold the farm to their son. They actually felt then as if they had divorced themselves from the soil. Then the problem which faced them was what to do with time. They wanted to believe that at last they reached the goal of life without work or worry. They had worked from daylight till dark, and soon commenced to realize that to be idle was even harder for them than work had been. To them, life meant work. Time, what did it mean? His mate found new diversion in the church work and ladies' aid, but my brother tried to conquer time by going downtown to co-op station and chat with the old timers. But one by one, they passed on. My brother had been one of the pallbearers on four different occasions as his neighbors and pioneers passed away. Of the original homesteaders in the community who had filed on land, there were only two remaining when my brother died. And my brother was one of them. When we drove to the church where the funeral services were to be held, I thought of the past. In my life story, I told about the thrashing outfit I had in this community. I commenced to realize 28 years have gone by since I passed in this community. Those I saw at a funeral were not many of the old timers, but children who were either not born then or were very small. There were a few old timers there that I could count them on the fingers in one hand. Yes, time goes by and the young generation today have no place to escape to. There's no more frontiers. Yes, the changes are much greater than any of us realize. After the funeral, we gathered at my nephew's farm home for funeral feast. During the discussion, we talked about the farm surplus and what to do with them and other farm problems. I stated the farm surplus was really not surpluses, that this problem could be partly solved by free trade with these countries behind the so-called Iron Curtain. They all seemed to agree with this, but here the conversation took a different turn. Somehow, people were afraid to talk about life. My brother from Canada told a story of a very interesting incident in this neighborhood. His neighbor had lost some chickens, and he heard the noise that came from the direction of his chicken coop. So he took his old trusty shotgun from the peg on the wall, loaded both barrels, crept silently through the kitchen door, slowly and quietly moved towards the chicken coop. He did not take time to dress, but went out in his long underwear with the flap of his seat open. Slowly, he crept forward, the double-barreled shotgun pointed towards the window of the chicken coop. Slowly, slowly, step by step, there was no sound. He did not realize the flap of his long underwear was down, but his dog, a very good watchdog, noticed that everything was not what it should be.